There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
It's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. And please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is Zuzu Mansour, the lead singer and frontwoman for the Philadelphia band Soraya. They've been active since the early 2000s. And their latest single, Hammer and the Anvil, is available from Wicked Cool Records. And it's also a recent Coolest Song of the World here in the Underground Garage. We'll hear it now, followed by my interview with Zuzu on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
I hold tight to this secret, just one lie to remain. I take a bite of your apple, now I'm stuck in the game. Lay all my cards on the table, to your defiance. There's a burden in my heart. Where will I find a asylum? Round and round we fall, with a battle cry we crawl. Watch the moon outshine the sun. We die every time we run. Every time we run. Just like the hammer and the anvil.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it is time for your Coolest Conversations. And joining me is Zuzu Mansour, front woman, lead singer for Philadelphia's Soraya. Their latest single, Hammer and the Anvil, is out now on Wicked Cool Records, and it's our coolest song in the world this week. How are you, Zuzu?
I'm doing great, Manfred. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. You know, the last time we spoke, oh my goodness gracious, was back in January 2020. Anything happened since then?
Yeah, a lot of things. We recorded a new album in that time. We recorded a few new singles. We went to Sweden. A lot of things going on, a lot of traveling, West Coast, East Coast, bumping around the country again. We did a Midwest tour again, so keeping active.
Yeah, I guess there was also a pandemic since the last time we spoke.
We were right in the, almost at a year mark at that point, and then actually, I think the last time we spoke, I had just been in LA doing a video for the single that we talked about. So, yeah, a lot was started then. We started making plans for going back on the road in June. And, a lot started about 6 months after we spoke, too.
Wow. Well, your coolest song of the world is the new single, Hammer and the Anvil. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. But first, I wanted to ask you about your current guitar player, Mike Dudalovich, because we know him in the Underground Garage as a member of the Nuclears. And in fact, I've spoken with him before in our Coolest Conversations. How did Mike wind up playing with y'all?
Well, oddly enough, a few years ago, we've always played with the Nuclears, and we hit New York, and we brought them to Philly, and we go to them in Brooklyn. And so we just started playing together a lot, really good friends. And during the pandemic, Mike had given me a call. He'd learned our songs in case anything ever happened, you know, when we were on the road. And he's like, you need anyone to play guitar? And I said, yeah, we always need someone to play guitar. So he just started playing with us last year. I think the Nuclears were ending, and he was starting a solo project. And, you know, so he was doing a few new things, and he just wanted to, you know, get back on the road and play. And So he just started playing with us, and we just kept playing together. So when the album came up, he recorded the album with us. Yeah, he was a good friend first, you know what I mean? So it was good to get him in the group, and it was very easy, an easy transition, and he's been great. So
you said he was a friend first, so it's kind of like him joining is in the family, in a sense, right?
Oh, yeah, and he'll always be in the family. Like, you know, it's always going to be that way with any member of Soraya. That's especially with him, I think, because he started out, you know, we played with him so much, and, you know, it's probably the most natural it felt, having someone come in and start playing the songs, you know.
Did you say that he had just learned the songs on his own and then just contacted you after the fact to say, yeah, you know, I learned all your songs. If you ever need me, just let me know.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. What happened was we were playing with them a lot. Like, you know, we went through periods where we play a lot with the Nuclears, and we wouldn't see them for a while. Then we play a lot with the Nuclear. You know how it is. And so what happened was our original guitarist, Mike Reisman, left. And as soon as he left, I said, hey, you know, Mike, you always play with us. Maybe it's a good idea. Do you want to learn the songs? He's like, I already kind of know them just from being at the shows all the time.
Oh, okay.
So it was an easy thing. And I had forgotten we talked about it. And so during the pandemic is when he called me and said, hey, if you, you know, just, I think he was reaching out to me to let me hear the new Nuclears record that was coming out. And he said, by the way, you know, if you ever need someone, I was like, oh, absolutely. You know, I never even thought of him because he was so committed to the Nuclears that I never, you know, aside from maybe a fill in once in a while, I never thought of him that way. So when he called to suggest it, I was like all about it. He's a great player, great person, easy to work with, fast, you know, perfect.
And he's on the new recording. He's on Hammer and the Anvil.
Yeah, he's on all of the new album. He's on Hammer and the Anvil. He's on Heartbreaker, you know, so he's on all those recordings.
So the song Hammer on the Anvil, my notes are saying that it was written by you along with the group's bass player, Travis Smith, and one C.B. Van Zandt. Can you tell us how you guys worked up the song and what Stephen's contribution is?
Absolutely. I'm kind of excited to talk about that. Actually, we sent in, you know, during the pandemic is when I sent in the tight lip demo and also, so we know there's always two singles with Wicked Cool Records before the album comes out. So I was sending in, you know, we'd been writing, but I knew some of the songs weren't quite, you know, single. But the one I thought was the right one, I sent to him, and he's like, no, 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 no. And then the next one I sent, he's like, no, 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 no. And I thought, you know, so then I sent him this one, which was actually originally titled... God, what was it called? Hammer and it wasn't the, cause I remember talking with him about using the word anvil, cause I wasn't sure I wanted to use that word. And he was, so we had a conversation about that word a lot, like two conversations about it. And he got his way because inevitably he convinced me that it made sense. But,
Hammer and the Sickle or, you know.
Oh, no, it was never anything like that. It was, the hammer was just in the title line.
Yeah.
And I wish I could remember. It's going to drive me crazy. Maybe I'll get it to you later. But the original title had hammer in it, and he changed it. He's like, I like this one. Let me play with it a little bit. And I was like, okay. And when Stephen wants to play with something, it can really shift like every way, or it can stay very similar to what it is and just be like slight shifts, you know?
Yeah.
So of course I'm always like, uh-oh, right? So he sends me, what's great about Stephen is he knows what he sounds like to other people. So he sends me a recording and he says, start listening at 5 minutes in because he was working it out, you know?
Yeah.
So I listened to it and it was awesome. It was, he basically took the song we sent him that me and Travis had written and he reworked the chorus and like some of the verse, but mostly the chorus. And he was very clear that he had a melody and lyrics for the chorus. And the melody and lyrics he sent me for the chorus, I really liked. So that wasn't even, you know, because this was all like virtually we wrote it. We didn't sit in a room and write it.
Right.
So what he sent me, I really, really liked. And usually I'm a little skeptical of using someone else's words because that's my big It's what I love to do, but I really like them. And I thought, let me write the rest. So I reworked the words I had a little bit, but I also changed them a lot. And it took me a while. I was listening to a lot of different songs at the time that kind of certain words, usually my process is all, when someone else sends me something like that, I'll listen to other songs and just certain words stick out to me. I was listening to something by Chris Cornell and something about, he was talking about like an apple as in the original Adam and Eve story, the way he used the apple reference. And I was like, I love that. Let me use that in Hammer and the Anvil. And just different pieces of songs like stuck out to me lyrically, like the like certain words. So I started building the song based around a chorus that Stephen had written, you know, and it was the whole idea of the original song I sent him stayed true, which was the idea of, you know, getting that spark. Like you're just looking for a spark with somebody and you're trying to turn it into, or you have the spark with somebody, excuse me, and you're trying to turn it into more. And the frustration of trying to turn it into more all the time in my life, it's like immense. So I can write about that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's the idea of Hammer and the Anvil is like, you got the spark. Now I'm trying to make it something more.
So let me ask you then, since he's the one that came up with the notion of the anvil as a juxtaposition to the hammer, and that's creating the spark. Did you have some type of, before he came up with this idea of the anvil, did you have something going on lyrically, something else that was creating a spark, or that wasn't developed to that point yet?
Yeah, that's what's making me crazy, because I wish I could find the demo of the song, because it was hammer and something, but it wasn't that visual at all.
Yeah.
It wasn't that type of visual. I honestly, I can't remember because it's been changed for so long.
Right.
And we've
right.
written it and sent it to him, and then it changed right away. But I know the whole idea of the song never changed. It was still, he's really good at knowing what your idea is. If he ends up working on the song that's already been written with you, taking that idea and making it a simpler lyrical version of what you're trying to say. One of my stumbling blocks has always been, I have this, the opposite of an economy of words. I have too many words, too many conflicting ideas that sometimes my simple way of getting there, it takes me longer to make it simple than to start out simple. And he seems to go for that first, which is why I love writing with him.
Yeah,
he's very easy to take that. There's somebody else I wrote with that was like that, named Billy Falcon. He could do that too, and make just the simplest notion, which actually for me, as a listener to music, it speaks to me more than overcomplicating it, you know? So that's why I love balancing out. Stephen balances out my overcomplication. But yeah, I honestly can't remember Manfred. I apologize for that, you know, that whatever that original lyric was. I'm going to find it and send it to you either way, unless you want me to find it real quick now, which is possible.
Well, we got to keep talking right now, but I do want, if you find it later on, let me know just out of curiosity.
Me too. It's going to bother me too, trust me.
So when and where did you actually record? You worked out the arrangements with him. This is kind of virtual, going back and forth. When and where did you actually record it?
We recorded it at Renegade Studios in New York. Most everything we've done, except for I think Evergreen, like the lyrics or the vocals and the background vocals for Evergreen, were done at a studio in Philadelphia. But everything since Dead Reckoning, we've recorded at Renegade, and always with Jeff Sanoff. And Stephen usually either produces or he's involved in some way in our recordings, unless it's like a single release, like just a single being recorded.
And where do you stay when you are in New York? I mean, when you're doing that, you're staying in New York. Well, where do you stay? Do you have friends and stuff to stay with?
No, actually, I think you suggested the Jane, New York City.
Yeah.
And we love it. Like, we love having that, like, shared bathroom and the bunk beds. And it's ideal for us because, you know, you're done a full day of recording. All you just need is a place to sleep and a
Absolutely.
Place to
shower.
So it was ideal for that. That really worked. Plus, it's really nice not to have to bring a car. You can just walk to the studio. It's, you got to get ideas going when you're doing your walk in the
right.
morning. So I love that. And
well,
there's no pressure.
Too, I've got to tell you, friends of mine in, what are we now, June in May is before June, right? So it was May. So friends of mine stayed at the Jane, and they said, oh, they were told it's going to be turned into a private club.
Oh, no.
And that's just the worst.
No, that's upsetting.
And I hope that, I mean, what's so great about it is you describe the bunk beds and things in there that, you know, it has this great character to it, and it's this turn-of-the-century sort of old hotel, and turning it into a private club, I don't know if, you know, if they're going to screw with all the rooms and things. That just seems like a disaster, just a loss to everybody.
It is. It's really sad. It has such character, and that's what I loved about it. Like, I love staying there. I love... We insist that it's haunted, for sure. And
it has to be.
Going on there. I mean, why do you want to mess with that? So, but there is, I think now there's that club on the roof that they have. Because I know the one night we were there, there was a line down the street. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope we can get in. And they were all just going to, there was one night or one or two nights, I think on the weekend, they had a club all the way on the roof.
I see.
But it didn't affect us. We didn't even hear it. So, I mean.
Well, I know that there's also this downstairs cafe area, and sometimes it seems like they do events in there. But the same couple told me that they had tried to eat in that little cafe, and that there was someone had set up the cafe and received a lot of money to set it up, and then they just took off with the money. The Jane itself, very cool, but I hope it sticks around. But they've had some weird stuff going on there for sure.
Yeah, that's too bad. I love it.
You recorded there at Renegade, and Jeff was engineering. You got Stephen sitting in and producing. The new single is available on red vinyl, the artwork by Campbell King. Who's Campbell King?
Well, she's just one of the many people we know from just social media that's a fan of the band. And, you know, she was somebody who kept posting her artwork. I always loved her artwork. And, you know, I Brianna and Travis do a lot of artwork for us.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just don't have that inspiration. Like, you know, and I could tell, like, some of the stuff that I was getting wasn't quite... it didn't hit me, you know? So I was like, let me reach out to Campbell. And I reached out to her, and she was excited. She wanted to do it. I think just bringing other artists in to have a different vision of your work. That's like what I like to do with the videos too. It's just a different story being told than just your own. It kind of makes it bigger in my mind than just your interpretation. I told her what the song was about. I said I'd like something literal, but not too literal. Mm-hmm. And she's the one who came up with the image. So, and I just told her the color scheme that I wanted. And she did it in like a day, maybe two.
Wow.
Maybe two.
Very
cool. She was fast.
So the new single, Hammer on the Anvil, that'll be part of this upcoming album due out in the fall.
Yep.
So, and all the songs are finished recording and mixed and mastered?
Yeah, actually, Hammer and the Anvil and Heartbreaker were the last two songs to be recorded in October of 21. And the album comes out October of this year. So,
very cool. And before it comes out, you got this single now. You mentioned that Wicked Cool having like normally two singles before. So there'll be another single before the album comes out in the fall?
No, actually, there will be another single coming out, but that's digital. There's two hard singles. The Tight Lipped was the first that came out on pink and black vinyl last year, and this is the second on red vinyl. And then we have another single right before pre-orders start for the album.
Right, and that's the digital single.
Yep.
And that comes out in August?
Yeah, August 19th, I Seek Fire.
Cool, that sounds cool. So you're going to make a video for that one?
Yes, we are. We actually just got home last night from filming the video for that one. It was amazing. We're very excited. We were in your neck of the woods. We were in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. So So tell me, say again, because now you're in Sweden right now.
Yes.
So you just made this video. When did you do that?
Oh, we did it. Actually, we did it in early June. We did it the first weekend in June. I went out like the end of May to work with, you know, the people that were working, the director had like talked to the director, the stylist, all those people. Cause it was another version again of the story of what the song really is about.
Uh-huh.
So we really had to work some things out, but yeah, we went out and then, we filmed that and we came home and immediately we flew right to Sweden right after.
Wow.
So Yeah, wow. it was like a whirlwind end of May through now. So, but we're off pretty much a lot until the fall again. So there's only a few shows here and there.
You know, I want to ask you about the stuff in Sweden, but first, God, that must have been so crazy that your last album, Dig Your Roots, came out, I think in March of 2020. It came out like right as the pandemic was kicking into high gear. I think you guys were actually on the road ready to do like record release shows when everything was shutting down. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. We were already in California, West Coast, and I think it hit when we were on our way to Vegas for our release show. It was, in other words, it didn't hit. It was already happening, but they had the CDC had announced that it was a pandemic at that. I remember the day that they did. We were driving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, and it was raining because it never rains in the desert, but it did this day, and which was the omen, right? And our release show was Friday, March 13th for Dig Your Roots, and that was the day it released, and it was. People were like not coming, and that's when it really started. And our last show of that tour was canceled. It was like we flew to San Francisco, played San Francisco, and then the next night's show was canceled. Flew home, and that was our very first, our actual Philadelphia release show was done virtually, and it was a mess because we didn't know what we were doing or how to work the technical side at that point. But it was really, it was a hit. I remember the day it released. Laying in bed in Vegas and just being like, didn't want to look at anything because the predominant, you know, news in the world was the pandemic. So our release seemed so small.
Yeah.
And that was really upsetting when you spend like a year, year and a half writing songs, recording songs, you know, and then you're also going, well, I don't want to, you know, this is a really important piece of work for me to release into the world and the band and all the work we did for it. And all the plans we had for it on our own, just touring wise. And that becomes so obsolete almost that day of its release. But the first thing I remember doing, because I was like, well, I have no control. I was sad. I was worried, you know, about what was happening. And I turned on, but I knew the show was happening. I knew that was happening either way. And I turned on my phone and the first two messages were from people who had at midnight listened to our whole album. So, and how much they loved it, like audio messages. Oh. So I chose to focus on that, you know, and not be too selfish about it, not to be too worried about it. You know, I thought it's going to do what it's supposed to do. And if it never really, and what it did was amazing. Like really during that time, we had to come up with new ways to market and stay active. And I think it also helped us all personally stay connected. Mm-hmm. Because we had this other thing we had to do it for besides ourselves. You know, I think it's really easy sometimes to get lost in like, poor me, you know what I mean? And that was a perfect opportunity for it to happen. And we had this album that we had to promote, you know, it almost became more important than everything else. And it kept us afloat. And so many of our fans were like, thank you so much for doing these weekly, Q&As and, you know, releasing the record and talking about the record. And we had so much to talk about. And I thought, thank you for watching it because we, you know, what would we do? Like we'd normally be on the road right now. And, it kept us connected. Like I said, it really did.
That's exactly what I wanted to touch on this because, and you mentioned doing your thing in Philadelphia as a virtual thing, but, throughout, you know, the summer, the rest of the year, you were doing really cool things online and being really creative about, like you just mentioned, these question and answer things and doing interviews. And I thought that you did a great job of, you know, keeping yourselves as much as possible, connecting to your fans and to get the word out, to get other people to tune in and find out about the band. And, you know, you didn't get the benefit of being able to do what we want to do is play a show.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, nobody was able to do anything, go out. And that I thought you did a great job working it that way. So with the, you know, fingers crossed and prayers that we don't go back into another situation like that anytime soon. But when the new album comes out, will you use any of those same sorts of ideas in addition to playing out, like doing these question answer things? I mean, I think those are all really good ways to try and reach people, or do you feel like, let's just concentrate on the shows, I'm sort of done with that?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. That was really nice. And I have to say it was really a struggle, because part of me wanted to sit back and do nothing and kind of feel sorry for myself. And the other part of me just took over, thank God. Right. So thank you for acknowledging it. Definitely. I think we learned a lot in that time. And I think that's the blessing of the time that happened, is we learned a lot about how to connect with our fans, you know, what excites them. And I don't think we actually gave ourselves the time to figure that out before, because we didn't really have it. We were always kind of very DIY, booking it, trying to get other bookings, trying to, like, you know, get on different stations, things like that. You know, when you do it yourself, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I never really had the time to sit and think of, like, really digest the feedback that was coming to us. Mm-hmm. And I really liked, there was something we tried. So yes, we will do Q&As. I really love doing the Q&As. We started doing tours where it's more compact, like we happen this time and then we're off and then we have it this time. So it's not like constant touring as much as it's been for us in the past, as much as, you know, a few weeks here, then we are off. A few weeks here, then we're off. A few weeks here. So it gives us time to do other things with the music and with the fan base. Maybe have what I really liked, like I mentioned earlier, working with Campbell King and outside artists for some of the work and some of the cover art we've done, is you have this network in your fan base of artists.
Yeah.
And inevitably they become collaborators with the videos that happened, with some of the album artwork that happened, the ideas for album artwork that happened, photographers, artists. And I think, like, you know, people always talk about expanding. I'm like, when you work with people outside of your comfort zone, I guess, and don't know what to expect, I think it's sometimes really the most glorious thing. Like, even if it's not what you expected it to be, it's very inspiring. And I don't know about you, I'm constantly looking for that inspiration, that newness, taking risks, leaving my comfort zone. So I think there's going to be a lot more of that. It had to happen during the pandemic. We had to try everything. One of the things we did do also that I'd like to do when this album releases is some of the songs that we want cover, because there's, when it comes to cover songs, we're always like, there's a million, and it sometimes seems overwhelming, like, what's going to work? And then, like I mentioned earlier, I overthink it. And I start going like, well, maybe we should do this one because this riff is cool. Or maybe we should do this one because I love the lyric and the story. Or maybe we should do this one because, you know, the drums sound really cool. You know, and I can get stuck and I end up just like going, well, just do whatever. We used to do these one and dones virtually because we couldn't all meet. And Travis Smith, our bass player, is really good with the audio. So he'll say, just here's the song, record to it, I'll put it together and keep your video on. And it sounds like we're doing it together. We'll definitely do more of that, I think. We'll probably do it together, though, just do more acoustic.
Yeah.
So you can see what the song actually was. Like with Hammer and the Anvil, we gave away to the pre-orders the original demo of the song, which is different than the actual song. But the original demo of Hammer and the Anvil was what we worked out with Steven, and then the middle section Travis and I wrote, but we didn't have the lyrics. So on there is just the background vocals, which actually stayed the same miraculously. but there's no lyric there. So it's like part of it is inviting people into the process of the song too, that it's not like this just this end result. It, you know, it changes from the time you first have the idea, then you work together and you write it together and it changes again. Then if there's another writer, it changes again. Then you have to rewrite. Then you're doing a new middle section or a new section somewhere or adding a second guitar. Then you go in the studio and it changes. So it's like inviting people more into the process of how the song developed.
Yeah.
Is something I really like doing during the pandemic that I want to continue doing now. Because then they see it's like, it's a story. It's a story within many stories. And that's what I love about music, is the stories and the songs. You know, that's my favorite part. So I kind of want to highlight that. Travis and Brianna are very artistic, so they want to design some unique album covers, you know, for some of the people, like, you know, just something different. Like,
right.
I shouldn't say album covers, album inserts that are different on each one. So we're all kind of using our other our other loves or our loves of what brought us to music to kind of let people like a little more into our lives too. Fair. And that was during the pandemic. So,
well, so overseas, you're overseas right now. You're doing some shows in Sweden, I believe. This evening you're in Uppsala, which is north of Stockholm, I guess about an hour. How has the tour been going?
It's been really good. I mean, we played with Stupidity, who we played with last time when we went to Sweden the first time in October of 21, which was amazing. We started out the same venue in Malmo. We fly into Copenhagen, go right to Malmo. We love Malmo. That's in the south of Sweden. And then
Malmo is that the city that's just over the bridge from Copenhagen?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we always start there. By always, I mean the two times we've been to Sweden. We started in Malmo at Medley. I love that club. I think the whole band loves that club. And then we go up north to Stockholm. And, you know, Uppsala is only an hour from Stockholm. We're playing Norrtälje tomorrow night, ending the tour tomorrow night there. We still have some recording to do on Sunday. So we're just, when we come here, we always record with Sulu, who is the lead singer from Diamond Dogs. He's like an avid songwriter. And he always sends me like 30 songs. And I feel like I listen to more music just through him.
Well, you've done his song, one of his songs, right?
Yeah, Firebrand.
Firebrand, right. Well, how did you guys come in contact with him and meet him? Because is his band still active? Is Diamond Dog still active? Or what was the connection there?
Yeah, the connection was through Pelle, as our tour manager in Sweden.
Okay.
The whole way Sweden even happened is so odd, is there was a guy, Ludwig, who's a big fan of the band's, has been for probably 4 or 5 years. He wrote me one day and said, if you ever could come to Sweden, would you come? And I said, oh, yeah, definitely. But people write that, will you come to Italy? Will you come here? Please come here. You know, and it just never comes to fruition. But he was really adamant about it. And he went to a friend of his who tour manages, and Pelle, and he contacted me. And our original tour was there in June of 2020, and it got moved, obviously, a number of times.
Right.
But he's amazing. He's friends with Sulu from Diamond Dogs. So he said, while you're here in Sweden, why don't you record with a Swedish producer? And I was like, sure. You know, I'm always kind of open to trying things. There was no pressure. If it didn't turn out great, it wasn't the end of the world. It wasn't like, you know, maybe lose some money in a recording studio, but the experience itself is worth it. So we thought, why not try it? And we did last time, and we met him, and we had a nice talk in the pub, and then we went, and we used his rehearsal space to, he produced the song, and then we went in the studio, we did it in a day, and it came out great. So, and it was fun. You know, the process of working with another producer is always, you know, you're always growing as an artist, and you get new ideas for your own music. So to me, it's never a waste of anything. Unless it's like crazy amounts of money, then I have to think about it a little more.
But
it was a great experience. So we're going to do it. And part of it with that song was I love the title. I had never heard a title like that, like Firebrand, before. Like nobody put it that way. So he has a unique way of writing his lyrics, too, I feel like. So he had actually just written and recorded with Crystal Gayle. You know Crystal Gayle, the country music.
He does it with
a lot of artists. The guy just writes a lot, and he writes well. And we thought, it's so much less pressure when it's not your song, too. For me and Travis, I think we both feel less like we have to have that type A control of the outcome of it, you know? So it's kind of very fun. It's even more fun than recording your own stuff. It's like a nice little breather, especially we flew out there last time right after we finished recording Bloom, the upcoming album.
Okay.
Literally that week we finished and then we left for Sweden. So it was, you know, it was fun. So we're doing it again because it was fun last time. We're going to do one more. And I think we're actually going to cover a Helicopter song too. Just because we're in Sweden.
Wait, can you tell us what Helicopter song it'll be?
No, only because I'm not sure.
Oh,
we
okay.
Still, on Sunday we're recording that one. So we have to, there's like two options. So I don't want to say one and then it's the other one. That would be awful.
Or you could tell us which ones you're considering.
Well, let me tell you, one of them is Baby Borderline.
Okay.
That's one of them.
All right. Hey, tell me about the audiences in Sweden. Do they seem more reserved? Do they get crazy? What is it like playing to Swedish audiences?
I can tell you, it's similar to here in the sense of playing a new venue, because I remember the very first night, and it happened this time too with Medley. They're wild, and then and they buy up your stuff. Like as soon as you're done, they're right over at the merch. And in Stockholm, I always feel it's like a little reserved. Like it's like they're loud. Then you come on stage and they like kind of stand back and watch. And then they kind of let themselves get free, which I noticed is kind of similar to here. But when they get free, they really get free. You know what I mean? They get wild.
Well, what you're describing there's the New York cool. You know what I mean? Like Stockholm being the big city, New York the big city, in the sense that you play like if you guys come and play in L.A., it's that same thing. Where at first, people are just kind of all holding back. You know, they can't. It's like if you go play someplace out of the big towns, people just they're not worried about being cool. You know, they can be comfortable as cool as they are. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally agree. I never thought of it that way, and it's absolutely true. That's absolutely what it is like.
But the only difference, I would say, when you guys get over to Japan, the difference there is as soon as the first band plays, they're all going totally batshit crazy. You know, it's
like
there's no holding back. It's like, no.
I love that.
No.
You know that affects you as you because you're an electric performer. So I see you on stage, and that audience energy is... I wouldn't say it's vital, but it's really important. It makes it more genuine for me. Like I'm not trying as hard, you know, I'm in it.
Well, that's a good way to think about it. It's, you're right. You know, that you feed off that energy. And if the energy in there is like, well, I'm up here doing what I enjoy doing. So whether there's, you know, 5 or 15 or 1500, I'm doing what I love to do. So that's going to be there. But then if you get anything back from the people, then that just only builds it, right? And it carries you. It carries you up. It just makes everything even better. But, you know, I'm going to do my job no matter what because this is what I love to do, right?
Right, yeah. Right. I think I stopped becoming as aware of... Sometimes I don't, you know, I'm on stage and I'm thinking about all the parts and I'm hearing all the parts, like... I'm hearing the harmonies, I'm hearing the bass line, I'm hearing the guitar, I'm hearing my vocal. If I'm struggling with the vocal, whatever, it's all, you know, hearing myself and stuff. I can get really focused on that when I'm not in the energy of it. And then when the energy kicks, I don't care about any of it. I don't care if I'm singing out of key. Like, I really don't care. I've lost the ability. That part of the brain shuts off. And that's what I always loved about punk rock. Like I remember seeing Iggy Pop, and to me, he's punk rock. I don't put it like specific box, but what I like about him is I'd see him live and he just didn't care. Like he just didn't care, you know, and there's a freedom in that as an audience member watching the show and being a part of the show, you get much more involved in it. And it's the same with that. What I think happened is as the audience was responding to, he's changing. So, but that's my experience of when there's a good, like awake, alive audience. It just is so freeing.
You mentioned these possible helicopter songs you might cover, and talking about covers in general. And we should focus here a bit on the B-side to the new single. You do a version of the Rolling Stones Heartbreaker. The original, I think, is on Goathead Soup, and that's from like 73. Well, why did you decide to cover that one? What was it about Heartbreaker that you guys wanted to do, tackle it?
Well, like I remember I mentioned earlier, I was like, we always have like 18 or million ideas for a cover, right? So at this point I was like, Heartbreaker was one of the first songs I remember ever covering as Soraya. One of the very first. I thought, why did we do that? Like out of all, you know, but it was really one of the first songs when I started performing out with a band that we did. And a fan of ours about 2 years ago suggested we cover the song. He out of the blue, and we hadn't done it for years, you know. In fact, I don't think anybody currently in the band was in my band when I did that song. It was when I very first started. And this fan was like, you should cover do-do-do-do-do, Heartbreaker by the Stones, I think you would kill it. And I thought, that's really weird you said that, because it was one of the first songs we covered. And I honestly didn't know the song that well at the time when I covered it.
Yeah.
And I thought, wouldn't it be cool? Because in my opinion, this album was like the third of a series of three. And that's why it's called Bloom. There's like a whole story behind that too. But I thought, wouldn't it be cool to circle back to the beginnings of when I started a band in the first place, and we covered a song that was one of the key songs that really got people moving and stuff in a club. And so that's why I chose it. Steven happened to walk in that day, and that's why it was produced by Steven. Isn't it funny how that happens?
Yeah.
It's the magic of rock and roll. But well, we were doing it pretty much the way the Stones had done it, because, you know, it's the Stones. So, and I love the song as it is. He's like, you can't cover a Stone song like just like they did it. And I thought, why not? It's what we're doing. And he's like, I have an idea. You want to do it? And I was like, yeah, let's. And once he goes, and especially when he's in that flow, you get really inspired to like just give him what he wants. I'm really proud of this one. I really love the way it came out.
So let me ask you about this, because so the original's got kind of this funky vibe to it, and your version's more of a rock version. So his idea was to get it away from that sort of funky thing?
I don't know that it was particular to getting it away from the funky thing. He just did not want us to cover it exactly like the Stones. And if I'm honest, we were covering it exactly like the Stones version. Sometimes I like doing that too. And I don't know if it's laziness as much as it just is I love the song as it is. It might be a little bit of both. But he came in and he had this whole idea for the beginning that was very theatrical, and I love that. Yeah. Like, I don't want the whole song to be that, but I love the idea of starting out with this, like, dramatic beginning. He did it with Trash, too, if you remember the cover of the New York Dolls song we did, which I, you know, that's a different story. But, yeah, he came in and he wanted this big, like, you know, that you hear the cymbal swell in the beginning, and then it's, shh, the police in New York City. And he just, we spent so much time finding the right key too for my voice, and he kept changing it.
Yeah.
That when we finally got it, he was like, now when we kick in, let's make it super fast. Like we were having a rough time keeping up with how fast he wanted it in the studio. Like he wanted it fast. And we're just like, you know, and your head's going like, is this even good? Like, you know, and I was like, just do it, just get it done. Like, and now I love it. Like hearing it back, you know, you can't really tell when you're in the middle of recording if it's even, you've so many demons talking to you in your head about, oh, you shouldn't or you should. And I've learned to ignore them during the process, especially being produced by Steven. He's very particular, right? So it was really the beginning he came up with first, finding that key. And then even the arrangement of the song was so odd to me.
Yeah.
But again, hearing it back, it works. You know, you're doing the second verse first.
Right, right. Well, it's like you give that little dramatic opening, you know, from the first half of the first verse. And then when the song kicks in, you're picking up the lyrics from the beginning of the second verse.
Right.
And that was all his idea, to change the arrangement up that way.
Yeah, he wanted to change the arrangement up. And then he also, with the do's, he was very particular that he wanted that, like, do, that higher do to start the phrase.
Yeah.
Because when we went in to record it the second day, Steven wasn't there. And I remember Jeff saying, you keep doing that one note out of, you know, high at a higher. And I said, that's what he wanted it. Like, I knew he really was adamant about that. And I hear it now. And then the one breakdown verse, I think I re-recorded that a few times, and the mix came back a few times, because he really wanted to capture those little sounds in your voice that emote, you know, that part of the phrase, but they're really just like breaths or a squeak or something that's just natural when you're singing that lyric. And he got it. Yeah, I thought he was being really particular, but at the end of the day, it was like the sixth or seventh mix of that particular verse. And I was like, wow.
We're talking about the breakdown, which is just the backing, the do-do-do's going on, right?
No, we're talking about there's a verse that all you hear is the drum. It's the second verse, and it's kind of in the middle of the song. So, you know, it starts with the first verse slow, right?
Right.
Kicks in with the second verse. So the way I look at it is the official beginning, and that's the chorus, and that's the first verse again, chorus, and then it's the accent breakdowns. And then it comes back in with the quiet verse. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you about, what I love, is this breakdown where it's, you know, everything drops out and it's just the do-do-do's going on, which I think sounds killer.
Yeah.
And you can hear everything very clearly. And you talked about, you know, the emotive qualities of that. And there's somebody singing a low do in there. That's like, who is doing that? Who has that low, singing that low do-do-do's going on in there?
That's Travis.
That's Travis. Oh, that's great.
Travis has the lowest voice I've ever heard. He sometimes just jokingly sings some Johnny Cash, like almost like an entire octave below Johnny Cash in the car.
Yeah.
When we're on tour, it's the greatest sound I've ever. I'm like, man, he's got that voice, got that low voice. And Brianna has that high ethereal, you know, voice, you know, so it's a really nice mix when they sing.
Yeah. Oh, and there it's highlighted in that with it's just them with just, you know, the back vocal part going on, and they're just, oh, that's really a cool breakdown in there. And and something else about the song, who is playing the, it's, I don't know whether it's congas or bongos.
Bongos.
Is it Brianna? Who is playing that part, that instrument?
You know, it's so funny because it's all running together, because Travis played bongos in one song. I think that one was Brianna. That's Brianna. Brianna usually plays the bongos.
Yeah.
I think Jokers, Thieves, and Liars, which is on the album, Travis played the bongos. So, because he had a really cool idea for the bongos for that, and it was very off kind of beat. So, yeah, that song is all Brianna. The builds of the bongos coming back in after the dude. Yep.
Very, very cool. Zuzu, I want to thank you for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
I had a great time, man, Fred. I always do. Thank you so much.
Well, we're going to give the new singles B-side a listen now. It's Soraya, their version of Heartbreaker in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
The police in New York City, they chased a boy right through the park in a case of mistaken identity. They put a bullet right through his heart.
That was some of Soraya's version of the Rolling Stones' Heartbreak here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. It's the B-side to their new single, Hammer and the Anvil, out now on Wicked Cool Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's frontwoman, Zuzu Mansour, for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. And thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Michael Monroe, the former lead singer of Hanoi Rocks, now he's got a new solo album out now called I Live Too Fast to Die Young. We'll find out all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.